You are listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, when I was coming right out of college, my sister asked me to meet her in Italy for a vacation. She was living in Europe at the time and said, man, why don't you meet me over there? But I haven't made any plans, so can you sketch out an itinerary and just meet me in Rome? And so I went for the next several days, pulled out all these different books and began to study Rome because I wanted to see all the ancient sites, and I was trying to sketch out an itinerary for a few days in Rome, a few days in Florence, a day in Cinque Terre. And so as I was doing that, it dawned on me, wait a minute, I have one buddy that's been there. And he's journeyed through there. Let me ask him his experience of how to maximize my time visiting all these amazing ancient sites. And so I sat down with him and I said, man, show me how to use my time. He's like, no problem, dude. He was like, Rome, you're going to want to give it at least 3 days. He said, the first day, you're going to go to the Pantheon. Pantheon was an ancient temple to the gods, finished by Emperor Hadrian. You're going to want to show up there and walk past it and take a left because there's a gelato spot there. And they got rice-flavored gelato, and you're going to want to make sure you try it. I'm like, what? And then he was like, and then the next day, you're going to want to go to Vatican City. Leave yourself all day, because there's a gelato place right out front, and the line gets really long. And he's like, and then when you go to the ancient city, you'll see where Paul was in prison, the gelato place there. And I was like, wait, stop. What are you talking about? What is this gelato? And he was like, man, it's like ice cream, but it's just different. It's so much better. And I was like, man, I've had ice cream. Kind of thought we'd be talking more about Michelangelo's David. That's a bit more my priority than ice cream. And so I tell you what, I blew off his advice. I just got my own little itinerary. My sister and I went there. And for the first several days, we're seeing ancient sites. Absolutely amazing. I love Italy. It's incredible. And then as we were leaving the Pantheon after visiting it at one point, I said, you know what, there's this buddy of mine that was going on and on about this ice cream or whatever. I think we should go try it. And so we turned the corner, went to that place, and I ordered the weirdest looking one there. I was like, give me the rice-flavored gelato. And they handed it to me. And I remember I put it in my mouth and instantly mourned all those wasted days in Italy. I had not been ingesting this substance, and I repented before God and all of Italy for my mistake, and I reoriented the rest of our trip that ne'er would we miss a gelato space again. And I remember it dawned on me, man, I had had ice cream. I had even had stuff called gelato here in the States, but that was something else. It was made with a different ingredients. So much so that when my wife and I went back and she said, what's our itinerary? I was like, well, next to the Pantheon, we're gonna take a left. And I just did the same thing. I know the names are the same, but the ingredients here are so different. Now, why do I say that? Because we've been talking about relationships. We're talking about singleness. We're talking about how to date. We're talking about engagement. And now we're on to marriage. And it's been fascinating to me. I've read so many articles about the state of marriage today. So many interviews with young people. And I've done so many myself. And I got to tell you what I imagine many of you already know. Marriage has fallen on a bit of hard times. That still the vast majority of people in America that are unmarried say they want to be married, and the vast majority will get married, but less will be married than ever before. People are waiting longer to do it, and I see a pervasive cynicism about it. Even recently, as I read reports from people saying, you know what, I watch my relatives' marriages. I've seen every single one get divorced. Seen uncles get divorced and cousins, my own family. I've seen the pain in it, and so I don't even know if I want to be a part of that. Or I read a report even now in The Atlantic came out this week that said, you know, maybe marriage isn't even our best social institution. And you see a cynicism because a lot of pain. And when I read that, I understand it. Romance is a wonderfully powerful thing and a potentially very damaging thing. And many of us have been hurt by it. And many of us have been hurt by marriages that have gone wrong. Our parents, our people around us we care about. And so what I hear in the culture is people say, yeah, I've tried that. I've seen that. It's not working for me. And what I hear is, man, I've had ice cream. And I say, you know what? But there's a different set of ingredients. And I feel like you're missing out on the real thing. You got something called marriage, and yet it's missing some of the key elements that make it so sweet. And for me, I've been married for 15 years, and I tell people all the time, we're the happiest we've ever been in our marriage. And I can see in some people just that twinge of doubt. And I want to tell them, I promise you, you've not had gelato like this, right? There's a different set of ingredients that make it better than maybe what you've experienced so far. And I say that because, you know, we've got marriage, and honestly, in the country today, as I was reading all these articles this week about people rejecting marriage, they were rejecting it for reasons that I would reject too. They were saying marriage is just a lie. You promise someone you'll be faithful and then you end up cheating on them. Or marriages don't last and all that. And I go, you're rejecting the real because of the counterfeit. You're rejecting the real because of its abuses. Let's not do that. Let's go back to the real. Let's go back to created intent, because marriage is not an institution created by America. It's created by God. That we saw that Paul in Ephesians will quote Genesis chapter 2, that at the very beginning of humanity, God created this. Marriage is designed by God. And if we want beautiful marriages, let's look how the original author put it together, because when he made it, it was good. And you see in Genesis, as God was creating the world, seven times as he was creating the foundations of our world, he said, it's good, it's good, it's good. And then we get our first not good. He said, it's not good for that man to be alone. And he wasn't technically alone. God was there, and there's a lot of animals. But there's a big difference between watching a sunset with a woman or with a cocker spaniel. And God said, this is not good. Like, you're meant to have community. Not, it doesn't have to be strictly romantic, but we're meant to commune with one another. And so God knocked Adam out and then brought forth from his rib a woman. And when Adam saw her, he said, God made a helper suitable to him. Now, helper always sounds like it's diminishing. It's not meant to do that. God is called a helper in Psalm. And if you really feel like it diminishes it, helpers do what? They help. Who needs help? People who need help. And so it's a merciful thing to Adam. God saw this and said, this is not good. This man needs help. And Eve came into the picture, and what happened? When God is in the midst of a relationship, Adam sees her, and he breaks into song. At last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, you're like me. You're a complement to me, is what the text says. Peter called her a co-heir in the grace of life, because Genesis 1 says that both male and female created in the very image of God. He says, at last, one like me. You see poetry, you see beauty, you see vulnerability, but safety. I can be completely nude before you, transparent before your gaze, and yet feel safe. You have all of me. It is good. Marriage, the way God intended it, is good. It's designed by God and works well. And yet many of us don't see it that way. Why? Well, Genesis 3. When humanity severs the relationship with God, it's not just the relationship that God that breaks. Everything downstream is poisoned. And you see, the relationship gets difficult. Now this man who used his power to care, it says that he will rule over you. There'll be a domineering relationship here. That you'll see a difficulty enter into their relationship, so much so that what happens? Often I talk to people and they talk about the brokenness in their families. And they say it like it's a distancing thing from the rest of humanity. Well, y'all don't understand my family. You don't know what my parents are like. You don't know what my experiences. Look at the very first family. When there was just four humans on the planet, one brother murders the other. So some people think their pain in their family isolates them from the human story. No, the whole human story started crazy. That if you came to me and said, hey, one of my family members murdered the other, I'd say, that's a terrible story. But that's where all of our stories started. Families broke early. And as soon as we severed from God, families broke. And then Genesis, in poetic fashion, follows you seven lineages down, the number of perfection. Let's see perfectly what happens when our relationships wander from God. What happens? And seven generations down in those genealogies you never read, a guy named Lamech comes up. And you see seven generations of journeying away from God. What do you see? Lamech shows up and he says a poem to his two wives, Ada and Zillah. Ladies, tell me if this would stir your heart. You meet a guy, Lamech, seems nice. Lamech means conqueror, sounds like a go-getter. So he brings you on a honeymoon and sits you down next to his other wife and recites this poem. Listen to me, wives of Lamech. Aw. Feeling a little something? I have killed a man for wounding me, a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. And you go, what's the deal with that? When we're severed from God, what happens to this man? Ego takes hold. And out of his ego, he says, if someone even tries to wound me, I'll kill him. Even a boy in the flower of his youth, I'll murder him if he offends me. And then when it comes to women, no longer is a woman my co-heir. Now I'll take two of you, and their names translated mean ornament and tinkling. You think he cares about their intellectual concerns? Women become candy and disposable to be used by this man. You see that when we break our relationships away from God, every relationship breaks, and women lose, and men lose. And so many people today say maybe marriage is a dead institution, and what they're looking at is Lamech. And I would say I reject it too, and so does God. This is not what God made. The abuse that we see in a lot of our relationships, no one gets wounded more than people in romantic relationships in our culture, but that wounding is not the real. It's ice cream, but there's gelato here. That marriage is an institute designed by God. And when we use it his way, it's good. That's why Paul circles around to it in this passage. In Ephesians, he's talking in the first 3 chapters, there's no commands for you. It's all a story of what God has done for you, about how into our brokenness a healer was sent, into our woundedness, one to bind up our wounds, into our distress, a hero has come, Jesus Christ, to forgive, rescue, restore, redeem, bring you home. And then he shows you how to walk in this life. And he says, don't walk as unwise, but walk as wise. Wisdom is, I understand how God made the world, and I'm going to walk that way. And he says, don't be drunk with wine. Don't be controlled by a beverage, but be controlled by the very Spirit of God. That the best way to live life is the way God intended, filled with the Spirit, walking according to his word. And he says, as we do that, we'll speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. We won't use words to hurt each other, cut each other down, diminish each other, like some of you have experienced in your home. We'll speak life-giving words, encouraging words, caring words. And then as it bleeds into the family, he says, and we will submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, wives to our husbands. He says, marriage is designed by God. And when we use it his way, we all flourish. That God's given us an instruction not to diminish us, but to liberate us. It was designed by God. And when we do it his way, we win. But it's not just designed by God. It's meant to display something about God. That's why Paul brings it up here. He says the two become one flesh. And he says that's a mystery. And by mystery, he doesn't mean it's something confusing, like weird, isn't it? He says a mystery is something that was hidden and is now revealed. And he said the great mystery of Genesis is that it's not just talking about a male and a female. It's talking about Jesus and his church. That God is not distant up in the universe telling you, good luck, figure this world out. That Jesus Christ, the Son of God, came for us and loved us like a husband loves a wife. And he says, so when you get married, your marriage is not just designed by God, it displays something about God. Your unity tells a bigger story. That we talked about how singleness is good. Some of us will be single our whole lives, and that's not bad. Jesus was, and the Apostle Paul, and God's given purpose to singleness. Singleness exists to pursue an undistracted devotion to the Lord. I leverage singleness to be devoted to him, but marriage is also good. Singleness is about devotion to the Lord. Marriage is about displaying something about the Lord. That the world gets to see a picture of how Jesus, the Son of God, loves his church and the way husbands treat their wives. That's one of the main reasons Christians get married. It's not just for the tax breaks. It's because we love Jesus Christ, and the way we treat each other as husband and wife shows the world the beauty of what can be. And let me tell you something. Ancient Rome saw this. For me, as a church history major, I was so confused by that. How did a culture like Rome, which was so against Christianity, suddenly adopt it in such massive ways it changed the entire empire? How did that happen? And I wanted to understand it. I read all the books, and most of them were garbage. But there was one book that really displayed it. How did it happen? How do you get a Roman that had just a totally different relational dynamic. Then men had all the power, and so women were disposable. You'd marry one to be a breeder to pass on your DNA. You would work with another that was your intellectual equal, and then you'd have a couple side chicks that were sort of your sexual playmates. And that's how men ruled in Rome. How did these guys suddenly step into a Christianity where believing in Jesus Christ would at least make you lose your job, probably get you killed, and then encourage you to have a monogamous marriage your whole life? How would this guy sign up for that? And what I found was, for most of them, what they saw was the Christian marriage. They would see women win. Women are elevated. They're esteemed and valued when marriage is done God's way. And it elevates men. They don't act like beasts anymore. They act like sons of God. Children win. So they would look at Christians and say, your theology is so backwards. Your book is regressive. You're so strange, but you're also better. Your lives, you just seem to be doing better. And it was often the beauty of Christian marriage that lured people to know Jesus, because marriage is designed by God to display something about God. So we need to figure out how to do it right. And in this passage, Paul focuses in on wives and on husbands and gives them particular commands that, frankly, I know feel a bit controversial. To be honest, I thought about not teaching this passage, not because I'm scared of it. Well, maybe a little because I'm scared of it, but also because of timing. But I realized we got to talk about this. But I know as we get into it, as we talk to wives in verse 22, it says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And for me, that word submit feels like a bomb that you just set in the room. And I'm like, hey, let me see if I can dismantle this in front of all of us before it blows up. This seems fun. Like, let's try this out. It's a scary word. And yet Paul looks at wives and says, I want you to take your cues from the church. Show the world how the church responds to Jesus. And he grabs this word, submit. And I know it's not a fun word. No one in here is like, what a great verb. That's actually what I was planning on doing today. What do you want to do today? I don't know, submit. Like, nobody loves that word. Like, I talked to, I remember I did a focus group with a bunch of young single women, and I said, when you hear the word submit, tell me some words that come to mind. And I just wrote out words on the board, and they were all profoundly negative. And let me tell you something, I don't blame any of them, because most of them were thinking about being abused by domineering men that don't have their best interests in mind. Frankly, they were thinking about Lamech and the culture of the day. And I'd say, you're right. But don't throw away the ideal because of its abuses. Let's talk about what this means, because this is given from a God who's good and cares about us. He's not trying to hurt you. He's trying to set you free. So what does he mean when he says this to women? Let's talk about what he doesn't mean, and then let's talk about what he does mean. What he doesn't mean with that word submit is subjugation, that one human being subjugates another, or in this case, men subjugating women. That's not what it means. There's actually nowhere in the Bible where any human being is called to subjugate another human being. The person with that power is God alone. This word, the verb, is in the middle tense in Greek. And what does the middle tense of a verb mean? The middle tense means you do that verb to yourself. This is a call to women that they have a choice and they freely choose to enter into this relationship with a man that works in a certain way. So this isn't all women submitting to all men. It doesn't work that way. I've had girls tell me, how do I submit to my boyfriend? And my answer is, you don't. I don't even know what that means. This is talking about a woman entering into a covenant of marriage, which is a serious thing. And so when I enter into that, I'm taking on a different level of responsibilities with this particular person, what the text will say later, your own husband. This isn't all men, this is that guy that I'm committing to treat him in a certain way. And so this isn't him domineering me, and it's not servitude. It's not me saying that I become his maid. It's not me saying I become less than. It's not me saying that I'm second place. Ontologically, we are equal. It is always presented that way, that women and men are co-heirs of the very grace of God. This is not meant to diminish women at all. It doesn't mean that you have to sit back and be silent. It doesn't mean that women don't talk. Look at Proverbs 31. The Proverbs 31 woman is launching small businesses, buying and selling real estate. She's getting stuff done. So this isn't telling some woman to just go sit in the back and wait for someone to call on you. That's not what's happening in this text, okay? That's the abuse, not the good. That's ice cream, it's not gelato. So what does the word mean? Well, what it means, and let me give you a very wooden way to say it, submission for a wife is an inclination to receive and affirm a husband's leadership. It's an inclination to receive and affirm a husband's leadership. Now, we'll talk about what leadership means in a minute, but let's just talk about that for a minute. I like the word inclination because what it means is it talks about a general disposition or posture. It doesn't mean that a woman can't initiate. It doesn't mean, well, I have a good idea about how to solve this problem for my family, but I'm the woman, so I'm supposed to wait till he figures it out, even though all of us figured it out a few days ago. Let's just wait. He'll get there. Come on, baby. Like, that's not what this is saying. Women present ideas, make decisions, all that kind of stuff. But there's a general disposition that says, I want to understand that when this man took on the role of husband, he shouldered some responsibility under God. That God will tell him, as a husband, you are supposed to use that male strength to position the world in such a way where that woman wins and those kids win. That men use power. They have it. And often in the world today, they use it for selfishness, and women and children lose. Look at the statistics. And yet when a man becomes a husband, it says you take that power and you channel it towards caring for that woman and caring for those children in a fully orbed way. And if you don't, I'm coming after you. That's what God says. That's why when he showed up in the garden, he says, Adam, where are you? What have you done? That's why Peter says to the man, you treat that woman right. If not, God does not want to hear you pray. That this whole different weight is put on that man to use his power for her. And you want him to feel that. You want him to feel that kind of weight, that under God, I'm meant to treat her like she's God's daughter. For me, I have an expectation for a man, if he's even going to make eye contact with my daughter. And if he treats her wrong, he's got to deal with me. And I want him to be aware. I love you, all smiles. I'm going to assume you're a friend to start, but if you go sideways, I'm coming for you, son. He needs to feel that from the father. And men are meant to feel that under God, I need to use my power and my strength in a way that help this woman and these children win. I need to feel that. You want him to. If we look at the problems of the world today, I don't know any that are saying, well, the problem is men that are initiating too much on behalf of their family. That is not the issues you see in the world today. And let me tell you something. Most women I talk to, they want a man who will initiate. They long for it. I did this thought exercise with a group of young single women once, actually a stadium full of them. I said, ladies, just put it in a dating context. What guy would you rather go on a date with? A guy that says, hey, do you want to go out? And you say, yes, you get in his car. And when you get in the car, he goes, so what do you want to do? Or do you want to have the guy that when you get in the car, he goes, okay, I did some research. Wasn't sure what you were in the mood for, so I was looking at a bunch of different restaurants. I found this awesome little seafood place right along the coast. I figured we could eat there. It's got big windows, and then we could walk along the waterfront. I thought that'd be cool. Or, if you're not feeling that, there's also this little Italian place that's kind of tucked into the city. It's got this little garden patio, and we could just kind of have a more intimate vibe like that. So I wasn't sure what you were feeling, so I narrowed it down. What are you feeling? Seafood, Italian, where are you at? Ladies, which guy would you rather go on a date with? The initiator or Captain What Are You Gonna Do? When I presented this to a room full of women, no one cheered for this man. This guy got a standing ovation. And nobody was like, two restaurants? You trying to oppress me? Trying to hold me back? You trying to limit me? No, they appreciated the initiation and gladly received it and affirmed it. And that's what you want. You want to see a guy that's initiating on behalf of your good. And when he does it, affirm that. Affirm it. Get a posture where you go, he's called to do that. And when he does it, I want to celebrate it. So much of the pain in this world today is from the passivity of men. And let me tell you something. A lot of you feel that. You would have loved as a little girl for your dad to come up to you and say, get in the car, baby. Let's go. I got some errands to run. You're riding with me today. Some of you, your deepest wounding as a man is that your dad never initiated a conversation where he said, boy, let me tell you what I really think about you. And he said, I love you, and I'm by your side, and I care about you, and I see beautiful things that God's put in you, and I want to help you win in life. You long for that statement, and you've gone down many broken roads looking to fill that void. You long for the initiation of a man. It's hurt you when he didn't. And so when a guy is going to do it, receive it. Affirm it. because what's celebrated is repeated. So when you see him take his first fumbling steps towards spiritual initiation, maybe we should go to church. Affirm it. Don't be like, well, it's about time you finally figured that out. Don't do it. Because let me let you in on a secret. Most men I talk to are afraid to lead because leading's scary. If you say, let's go, and turn around and no one's following you, it's a little embarrassing. There's a vulnerability to leading. And so when a guy makes the decision to initiate, affirm that. As much as you can, celebrate what you can celebrate. Now, let me say this. As I talk about that, I know a lot of women hear this, and they get fearful because you go, well, if this is what's going to happen, do I lose freedoms? He's going to hurt me. He's going to take me away. I don't want to go. I'm scared of marriage because it's going to ruin my life. Most people, this whole idea of a man leading terrifies me because you think he's going to micromanage me or he's going to crush my dreams. And let me tell you something. That's not leadership. Micromanagement, crushing your dreams, is called bad leadership. Don't marry that guy. That's why who you marry is so important. Don't work for that boss. If you have a good leader, you celebrate. I remember for me, when my first job out of college was the first idea, just the thought crossed my mind, there might be a man that has some authority in my life, and I hated it. I realized I have an issue with authority. Like, I took a test recently, and it just kind of had a spectrum of human beings, and on one end of the spectrum was, man, I take instruction well, and the other end is, I hate it. It causes bile to rise in my throat. Like, don't you tell me what to do? And I was over here. Like, I was like, wow, in a class all my own. I'm like, that's really fascinating how much I resist the thought of you telling me what to do. But I showed up at this job, and I'll tell you the way this pastor led me. I was in charge of the youth ministry, and anytime we had a meeting, he would say, hey, Ben, what do you need? He said, what are you thinking about doing? What do you want to do? What do you want to see happen with these kids? How can I help you? And I realized after a while, he was studying me to see what my gifts were and then trying to think about how to set me up to use them and make them better. And then he was studying me to figure out what my vision was and trying to figure out how to access whatever resources we had to make it happen. And there was some guiding to it, but I never felt restricted. I actually felt liberated. I got to be more me, not less, because of him. And I was glad to have him. And that's what this is talking about. We'll get to the guy in a second, but you need to go, hey, you know what? God has positioned him in a place where he's going to initiate, and I want to respond in a way that affirms him. And I say, when I see him taking those first steps, I say, okay, I celebrate that. That's awesome. Let's do that. You want to do a Nate night? Yeah. Because here's the motivation in Ephesians 5:22. It says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And you go, what does as to the Lord mean? It means motivation. That now a function of my spirituality is how I treat that man. That it's not just why I worship God over here and then I deal with this guy over here. Like, no, God will be worshiped by the way I treat this guy. Those are now intertwined. So it's motivation and also comparison. It says the husband's the head of the wife, as Christ the head of the church's body. As the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. And that freaks people out too. They're like, in everything? What if he wants me to do something illegal? Yes, there are caveats to that. If your husband's like, let's start a cartel, the answer is no. Don't do it, because his leadership is always subject to God's leadership, right? And so, no, don't follow him into sin. But what this saying is it's trying to take this and show you the weight of marriage. Marriage is not a trifling thing. And here's the thing. Whether you agree with any of this or not, when you bind yourself to someone romantically, they have extraordinary power in your life. Even if you're just living together, they impact your sense of self, your sense of value, your sense of worth, your financial decisions, your future. So much enormous power is being handed to that person, whether you're doing it consciously or unconsciously. What the Bible is saying here is when you enter into a covenant, make sure it's a guy who's taken his cues from your king. And then when you knit together with him, your pursuit of the Lord is now lockstep with that man. So choose well. Get a good man that has a standard of morality outside of you, that wants to treat you well because he fears the Lord. And when you get a guy like that, let him know you believe in him. Let him know you trust him. Let him know when he does something great, you're going to affirm that. Don't shame him in front of other people, but celebrate him. Build him up, because he needs that. Now let's switch to the men, shall we? Okay, good. 41 words are used to instruct the wife, 116 for the man, because he needs help. So let's go. Verse 25, Paul instructs husbands to love your wives. That word love is the word agape in Greek. It's not the word storge like a buddy. It's not phileos like friendship. It's not eros like erotic love. It's talking about a different kind of love that can be translated variously in other places. But the idea it carries most often in the Bible is covenantal love. Not just an emotional feeling and certainly not just an erotic one. It is a binding together of I promise to love you in sickness and health till death do us part. You commit to that woman. You love her. What does that love look like? Paul qualifies it. He says, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So the man loves his wife the way Christ loved the church. What did Christ's love for the church look like? He qualifies that. And gave himself up for her. That gave himself up, that is not in the present tense. That is not continuous action. That is in the aorist tense. What does that mean? It sort of cues that it was a one-time moment. What was the moment where Christ gave himself up for us? It was that moment on the cross where he said, what does my bride, the church, need to win? Then I will provide it. They need redemption. I will redeem them. They need forgiveness. I'm bringing it. They need to be raised up into the fullness of sons and daughters of God. I will bring myself low to raise them high. You see Jesus initiate and sacrifice so his bride can be fully who she's meant to be under God. That's what a man does. And let me say this. I know when we talk about the women's role, I can feel the tension building because they're like, okay, I'm going to submit to this guy. I'm going to affirm his leadership, but he could abuse it. He could damage it. Let me tell you something. This whole structure only works if both people play their part. It's like tennis. If one person decides not to play, it's not much of a game. You get fined for that. You need both people to play. And so she's called to receive and affirm his leadership. What's he called to do? Initiate and sacrifice so she can be fully who she's meant to be under God. That's what Jesus did. He came for us when we were at our worst. He initiated. He did not wait. He didn't say, well, let them clean themselves up a little bit. And I'll give them a little ladder. They can work their way back to me. That's not what he did. While we were sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies, he came for us. He didn't wait for us to clean ourselves up. He didn't wait until we checked our attitude. He didn't wait for us to pretty up. He saw us at our worst and came running. He saw us when we were hurt and he came moving with healing. He saw us when we were broken and he came to make us whole. He saw us when we were frankly rude and he came with kindness. And then he sacrificed no home, no clothes, no esteem, sweat, drops of blood, and then poured out his blood till he died. Why? What was the point? That he might sanctify us, having cleansed us by the washing of the water with the word, so he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and blameless. He initiated, he moved towards us, and he sacrificed down to his very life to do what? To protect us. If sin is going to bring condemnation, I will take that condemnation. If my failure is bringing judgment, I will take that judgment. He said, I will protect them from the ravages of sin, and then I will provide for them whatever they need. That's the next part. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. So no one ever hated his own flesh, but he nourishes it, cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we're members of our body. He looked at us and was like, what do they need? They need forgiveness? I'm bringing it. They need hope? I got it. They need joy? I'm putting the very Spirit of God inside of them. And the fruit of that Spirit is joy. They need love? I am bringing the fullness of it because I am love. Whatever we needed, he provided. He initiated and sacrificed so he could protect and provide so we could be presented before him in splendor, fully who we're meant to be under God. That's what a man does. He initiates and he sacrifices so his wife can be fully who she's meant to be under God. And let me tell you something, ladies, you meet a guy like that, suddenly receiving and affirming, that guy gets way easier. That you know that he will sell his body for me to be fully who I'm meant to be under God, I can trust him. I can trust him. That's what a man does. This is godly stuff. Genesis chapter 1, we've talked about this before, when it was chaos, darkness, and void, God in the first 3 days built structure. Right? Sea, air, and land, the teleological support structures. And then the next 3 days, he filled that structure with life. He built form for the sake of fullness, structure for the sake of flourishing of all living things. And then he created us. And he told the man, cultivate. You take these raw materials that I've given you and position them in such a way that the world flourishes. And that's what a husband does. I have a limited amount of money, resources, time, energy, and my call under God is to initiate and sacrifice to create an environment that protects and provides for my family so they can flourish under God. That's what a man does. I initiate and sacrifice to create an environment where my wife can flourish under God. And so, men, I want to challenge you to do that. Initiate. Initiate romance. I remember hearing pastors say that. You got to date your wife. And I was always like, duh, like, of course I'm going to date my wife. We're going to go out, have some fun. It'll be great. Yeah, we'll go on dates. Well, oh, my gosh. And I have these romantic images in my mind. And then you get married. And you go to work, and work is hard, and the world is mean, and it is cruel. And you go home and sit on the couch, and then she says, how was your day? Exhausting. You turn on cable, comfort me, wash it all away, and just sort of watch TV. And what happens? After a while, the two of you just become roommates. And then what happens? I talk to guys all the time that are contemplating divorce, and what do they say? Man, our love just kind of, I don't know, it just kind of petered out. It just kind of faded. I'll say, man, love is like a fire. Fires fade because you don't stoke the flames. You didn't fall out of love, you fell out of trying. You're supposed to stoke that flame and stoke it. That's your job. Initiate. Initiate romance. Plan a date night. Hey, what are you doing Thursday? Let's write it down. I'm taking you out. And then go and pick a restaurant that's not ringed with TVs so you can listen with your face about what's going on in her life and take interest in it and care. Initiate romance. Initiate vacations. Take the lead on that. Don't wait for her to start. Jesus went first, and so do we. Initiate communication. I remember I had a professor say that. He said, gentlemen, when you get married, let me give you two pieces of advice. He said, number one, keep the flowers fresh. And we were like, what does that mean? Is that like a metaphor? And he was like, no. I mean, once a week, order flowers, have them come to the house, set them up in various places. I tried that. I'm not good at picking flowers. It's bad advice. I don't do it anymore. But the second piece of advice was very good. The second piece of advice, he said, never go to bed if you're in a fight with your girl. He said, it may lead to some sleepless nights, but it'll lead to peaceful days, man. Get that right. He said, do you know how to know? Pray together before you go to bed. Because it's hard to pray together if there's something bothering you. When you hold hands, it'll just come out. Lord, I just thank you for this day, and I just pray you would convict them of their sin and just smite them, God, smite them. Okay, you know, maybe we have something to talk about, okay? I feel like there's something going on here. And we got to talk. And he said, initiate that. Don't wait for her. Don't sit back and make her beg you to open up. Communicate. Let her know your heart. Initiate that communication. Initiate spiritual leadership. Don't make her drag you to church. Don't make her drag you to initiate raising the kids spiritually. It's not called babysitting if you're their dad. And some of you hear that and go, oh, okay, but you talk to guys all the time, like, yeah, I gotta babysit the kids. It's not babysitting when they're your children. But I'll tell you, there's something about it in men, and I think it's what the enemy does, just wants to pull us back into our own world. And it's a discipline sometimes to go, you know what? I want to be the kind of man Jesus was. I do want to do that. But it takes often a volitional decision. I will go and read that book with my kids. I will go and sit down with my wife and say, how was your day? I will initiate. And it will sometimes, because I think of the culture, feel awkward. But then when you step into it, you go, this is what it feels like to be a husband. To be one that I'm meant to be. Initiate. And then sacrifice. Look at what you have control over and say, how do I position it so that my wife and my children win? That's what a man does. I counsel young men when they're getting married. I say, here's what you're going to be tempted to do. I said, there's going to be things that you like, and as you begin to budget as a family, you will call them needs. There will be things that she wants, and you will call them wants. I said, just watch it. As y'all are budgeting as a family, she'll say, oh my gosh, I really want to go on a vacation with my friends. We got this time. You'll go, you know, baby, as we're budgeting under the Lord, The first fruits, of course, go to him. And the rest, I really think we should be responsible. And your kind of selfishness of your building your friendships, maybe that should make it in the budget this year. But then meanwhile, you buy a big screen TV because you're like, because there's a new one and it's huge. And I can watch the whole game. The guys are life-size. I need to see all of them. And it's suddenly a need. You go, whoa, bro, don't do that. Don't bend the budget towards your preferences and leave hers out. You sacrifice so she wins. That doesn't mean you become her slave to her whims, but it does mean you become a student of what would make her most fully alive in God. And do that. I realize for me, I don't have to be great with all women. I don't. I have to be nice, right? But I don't have to know the ins and outs of all women. It's not what a husband has to do. I have to be the husband of one wife, that one. And I got to study her. What makes Donna fully alive under God? And I got to work on that kind of stuff. And it takes time to discover. I remember for me, when we first got married, I had a lot of understanding about husbandry and how it worked. And I thought, husbands build furniture. That's what a man does. And I remember as we got like furniture from IKEA, I hate building stuff. So I was like, okay, here it goes. Be a husband. And I sat down there with little instructions of the faceless guy and little baggies of stuff. And I'm in the middle of this and I hate it. It's punishment. And as I'm doing it, inevitably with each piece of furniture, Donna would be in the other room going, how's it going in there? I'm like, fine, it's fine. I'm doing husband stuff. And she would just kind of sort of start to circle. She'd pick up the instructions and look at them. I'm like, what are you doing? She'd kind of begin to sift through the bags and take things out of my hands, scooch me over, and I got offended. I was like, what, do you think I'm not a man? Think I can't provide? And then I became a student of us, and I realized 2 free hours. 2 hours, do whatever you want. What's Ben going to do? Easy. Read a book. Don't even have to think about it. Give me 2 free hours reading a book. You give Donna 2 free hours, what does she do? Something with her hands. She builds stuff. She paints. She writes music. She sculpts. We were on vacation this last week, and we were out there, and on the back patio, they had these chairs, and she was like, hey, what if we redid these chairs? Let's spray paint them and redo some stuff and do that. And she was like, oh, come on, let's go to Home Depot. And they went to Home Depot and then fixed these chairs. I would never do that. It never crossed my mind, ever. If someone's chair, I sit in it, and it snaps, I go, it's time for new chairs, bro. I'm never like, what if we fix this? I've never said, let's go to Home Depot. Doesn't cross my mind. But in the past town we lived in, we would go, and they all knew Donna by name. They're like, what's up, Donna? You need 3/4 inch? And they're like, oh, are you her husband? I'm like, yeah, I am. And I do a lot of things you don't know anything about, man. And I realized she likes to build stuff. And so I spend money on things I never thought I would. So the next birthday, I just bought wood, just a ton of wood. She was in heaven. She built a picnic bench from scratch. And she's out there like, ah, I'm loving it. And I'm like, that's great, awesome, because I don't want to do that and don't have to, and everybody wins. But what am I doing? I'm dedicating money to that, dedicating time for it. She does a lot raising the kids, so I'm trying to think of times where, hey, let me take them and you go. And we look out for each other in that way. How do we set each other up to win? That I want to initiate and I want to sacrifice so you can flourish under God. Not to hold you back, not to stifle you. That's not what a husband does, and that's not good leadership. A husband says, how did God build you? And I'm not going to be the servant to every need, but I am going to try to position the resources we have so that you win under God. So that when he sees his daughter, he sees her in all her splendor. Without stain, without blemish. That's what I want to do. And when the world sees a man treat a woman like that, they marvel. Ancient Rome did not believe in Jesus, but how did Rome change? They saw the beauty often in Christian marriages. And they'd say, you know what you believe is backwards, it's regressive, it's weird, but it's better. It just is better. And it truly is. Wayne Grudem, who literally wrote the book on biblical manhood and womanhood, entitled Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, was a seminary professor on the East Coast, went and spoke at an event in Arizona. And when he got there, he watched his wife's health improve. The dry air helped a lot of her physical ailments. So what did he do? Quit his job, move to a much less distinguished seminary in Phoenix. Why? Because you initiate and sacrifice so she flourishes under God. That's what biblical manhood and womanhood looks like. And as a husband initiates and sacrifices, and a woman responds and affirms, the world gets to see the beauty of how Jesus loves his church. And let me tell you, ladies, it's easy to follow a guy like that. And guys, it's pretty awesome to be a man like that. In World War II, the 101st Airborne Division was charged with liberating the city of Foy. And I remember reading the book Band of Brothers, made a TV show about it, about that very moment. And in that moment, Lieutenant Spears was in charge of these men. Spears, as he's presented in the book and in the show, was there because he was just kind of out for himself. I'm just trying to get the level of advancement I want for my own career and get out and do as little as possible. And so he was looking to just kind of ride, take it easy, coast out until he could leave. Had no intention of fighting on the front lines. And then they got called up in the 101st to take Foy. So he was called to lead that moment. They had to cross an open field, a very dangerous thing to do. So the trick there is you keep moving until you get into the city and can get solid cover and then go house to house and eliminate threats. As he ran out into the field and the shots began to fire, he in fear called all the men to hunker down, made them stop in the most dangerous and vulnerable place. Their colonel, Winters, who had been their lieutenant, is watching this happen, and as a good leader, it infuriates him. Your selfishness is jeopardizing these people, and he did what any leader would do. He prepared to run out there. But his CO told him, no, you need to see the whole battlefield and make commands from here. So he filled his position and he looked at a different Spears. It was Dyke who was out there. He looked at Lieutenant Spears and said, relieve Lieutenant Dyke. And Spears, without hesitation, charged out into that field through enemy fire. Relieved Dyke, circled with his men and said, what's going on? And they said, we're pinned down here and our other men are over there. We've been cut off with the enemy between us and our comms are down. We can't communicate to them where to advance. And he said, well, then wait here. And he stood up and sprinted into enemy lines. And they said it was so crazy, the enemy didn't fire him at first. They just kind of marveled at this guy who would just run at them. They're like, he is running right at us. And then he jumped the barricades and ran through them. And they're like, and he is just going right on by. And he connected with his men on the other side, communicated key information. And then they said, here was the crazy thing. Then he got up and ran back through enemy lines like leaping dudes and back to his guys in jeopardy. He said, at that point, they took it personal, started shooting at him, not just their weapons in their hands. They started shooting 88s at him. That's anti-tank machinery. And they said, that was impressive. They were after this guy. And he just ran to come get us and to lead us where we needed to be safe, and then to accomplish our mission. And they said, we gladly followed that man who risked his life for us to secure us and to lead us on whatever mission we've been called to accomplish. And let me tell you something, that's what a good husband does, and that's what Jesus has done. Jesus ran into the chaos of our brokenness, and the world's a broken place. So much of Lamech is in us. And yet Jesus didn't stand far off. He came running into the field. He initiated. And then he sacrificed, didn't just risk his life, he gave his life. Every drop of blood, that he who knew no sin became sin so that we might be right with God, that our failure lands on him, his forgiveness lands on us. Our wounds land on him, his healing comes to us. He takes on our identity as broken humanity, and we get to become sons and daughters of the King. He sacrificed so we could flourish, and it is a joy to follow a hero like that. And so before you get a relationship with any guy or girl right, get a relationship with this God right. A God who's not trying to oppress you, a God who's not holding you back, but a God who is charging in to set you free. It's a joy to follow a Jesus like that, with the freedom of our singleness devoted to him, and with our marriages displaying him. And when the world sees the love of a God like this, they will come. It happened in the past, and it will happen again. And I think cities will change, and countries will change when they see the family of God live his way. We flourish under his leadership. Praise God for a hero like him.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.